This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Professor Belden Fields about socialism, but before we do that, I'd like to say a word about the theme music that begins this program. I've had several questions about it. The saxophonist is John Ellis, who plays with the Charlie Hunter band. Charlie Hunter's a guitarist, and John Ellis is the featured saxophonist. Although this is a CD just with John Ellis and other sidemen playing jazz, the particular tune is called Grace, and those interested in some of the other of John Ellis's CDs may go to johnaxonellis.com. That's johnaxonellis.com. So with that response to some listener questions, let's now jump to socialism with Belden Fields. Belden, what is socialism? Is it a political system, an economic system, a philosophy?
All of the above.
Okay.
And there are many different variations on socialism. And let me just run down a few of these. You have something called utopian socialism. And the most famous of those historically were Fourier and Saint-Simon. And Robert Owen. And basically what utopian socialism attempted to do was to think of, theorize about, and also to create small communities in which there was communal ownership and sharing to break down the hierarchical arrangements of society.
And some of these utopian socialists were motivated by religious, ethical, I guess all of them would be motivated by ethical.
Some of them were motivated by religion. We had two very close to our area that were of some importance historically. One was the Rappite community. And the Rappites were close to the Shakers. They came out of the same inspiration. And they had initially been farther east in the United States. They go back to the early 1800s. And in 1816, they formed New Harmony, which still exists as a town just across the Wabash River from Illinois. New Harmony, Indiana, which is a 3.5-hour drive from here. And it's very interesting because the old buildings from New Harmony are still there. In the mid-20s, Father Rapp decided that he wanted to move his people back farther east. They were established in New York State and in Ohio, and they moved back. And then a secular community established itself. Robert Owen decided to buy it from Father Rapp. And there they established a community. It didn't last very long as a utopian socialist community. But while it was there, it was an incredible sort of experience. First of all, they established a different kind of pedagogy there that served as a predecessor to Montessori, actually, which was very interesting. Secondly, Robert Owen brought some of the best scientists from the Philadelphia Academy of Science. They came by barge from Philadelphia and established themselves there. And they were the ones that classified for the first time the flora and fauna of this area in Indiana and coming up to our area. Owen's son, Robert Dale Owen, became a congressman, and he introduced the legislation to create the Smithsonian Institution. I mean, really, there were some really important implications of this, though it was short-lived. It was secular. It was devoted to science and learning. Mm. There was a Working Man's Institute that one can still tour there that was created to educate people. Also in Nauvoo, there was something called Little Icaria, which is actually mentioned in Marx's Communist Manifesto. And that was established by Étienne Cabé. That was a society. It wasn't Christianity was declared as the religion, but it wasn't a heavily socialistic, it wasn't a heavily religious thing the way the Rappite community was.
Now, since you mentioned Karl Marx, let me ask a question that many people ask socialists, which is, are socialists communists?
Well, I think that, no, socialists don't have to be communists, but could be communists. Mm-hmm. There can be overlap. But let me carry on with the different kinds,
sure.
And then you'll see. There's another brand of socialists, and this is the one to which I adhere, which are democratic socialists, more pragmatic. If you are working within a system which has elections and possibilities for political activity to advance the cause of socialism, one works through those activities. In other words, you don't try to make a revolution in a liberal society. So that is a different kind. And here in the United States, we have a very old socialist party, and it is split into different branches. There's Democratic Socialists of America. There are a number of these. Now, what's interesting about this is that certain of the people who are involved with the Socialist Party did come from religious inspirations. For example, if you looked at A.J. Mustey, who was kind of across the board, he started being ordained in the Dutch Reformed Church, then went to Congregationalism, then became a Quaker, was one of the founders of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and chaired that, was also heavily involved in the early ages of the American Civil Liberties Union. He came from a religious inspiration. The same thing is true of Norman Thomas, who was head of the presidential candidate of the American Socialist Party. He was ordained as a Presbyterian. But the party itself did not have a religious orientation. Now, Eugene Debs, who preceded Norman Thomas, his father was a Presbyterian minister. But again, insofar as the party was concerned, it did not have a religious focus. All right, then you asked about communists, and the Rappite community was a communist community.
It was,
Yes. You had a number of Christian communists. Communities, which simply meant that everything was shared. Now, there's another kind of communism, which is Marxism-Leninism, and there are different varieties of that. There is the kind of Soviet Comintern sort of communism. A variation of that was the Yugoslav version, as is the Castro government in Cuba, and then you have Trotskyism, which is another manifestation, and Maoism was another manifestation. I'm not going to get into all the differences there, but those are Marxist-Leninists in the sense that they attempted to follow Marx's theoretical understandings and analysis of capitalism and Leninist strategies and tactics for bringing about socialism initially, and then finally communism. Then you have variations that could be called guild socialists in Britain and syndicalists in France. And these are socialists in England. They came out of the Chartist movement. And the very heavy emphasis is on building trade unions and empowering trade unions. Then you have something that was initially British as well, the cooperative socialists. And this was an attempt to create a cooperative movement. And it wasn't focused so much on producer cooperatives as on consumer cooperatives. In other words, the way in which people could realize their power was in coming together in an association and using their purchasing power. We have a co-op, a food co-op in this community, but it was seen as a large strategy. And actually, that was attractive to at least one of the famous German socialists, Edward Bernstein, with his evolutionary socialism. He was much taken with that idea. So it gives you an idea. I haven't covered all of them,
sure.
but there's
but
a wide
when
you
highlights.
Talk. Yeah,
sure.
when you talk about socialism, it's very complex because there were very different ways of looking at it.
Well, let me push us from the theoretical to. And the global to the local and the practical. You mentioned that you say we have a food co-op in Champaign-Urbana. Who's the we?
Well, the we would be the members of the co-op.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the idea of
but
the co-op.
What was the genesis for it? How did it get started? Was it started by socialists?
I don't think that the people who started the food co-op here, and I remember the beginning of that, necessarily considered themselves to be socialists. I mean, one thing that has happened consistently is that ideas can come out of socialist movements, and then they are taken over by other people who think that they're good ideas, mm-hmm. but don't consider themselves necessarily socialists.
So how does a food co-op work? To give us a little insight into practical
socialism. A food co-op works where people come together and they work in the co-op and they get credit on their purchases. And then other people can join who maybe are not workers, but they pay a membership fee. And then they pool their consumer power. Mm. And in doing so, they can purchase foods at lower prices, and they can also demand certain kinds of food. If you want only organic food, you can then use your collective purchasing power to get organic food at a lower price.
Now, why couldn't a good capitalist who wanted to save money be motivated to join or even start a co-op?
A good capitalist could do that. But the good capitalist would run into a problem in terms of any profit that would be generated. The good capitalist would want to keep the profit and say to the others, too bad, I'm number one, go away. That's the difference. I mean, there one thing that characterizes socialism is a sense of solidarity, whether you're talking about consumer or what, and strong limits that would be placed on individualism. So once you bring the capitalist to play in this, then the individualism, the egoism, and I'll even say the greed, because a lot of capitalist theorists think greed is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So that is something that socialists reject.
Okay.
And they reject the notion that we are essentially greedy, that there's something in the human nature that makes us essentially greedy.
Uh-huh.
And socialists, I think, would distinguish between a healthy concern for the self and the welfare of the self, your health, your mental attitude, and so on, from just an acquisitive notion like greed.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest for those who may have joined us after the top of the hour. On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with Professor Emeritus Belden Fields from the Political Science Department of the University of Illinois about socialism. And if you'd like to join the conversation and ask a question or make a comment or start an argument, Belden's eager for discussion. Please call us anywhere you hear the program. You may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, including listeners on the Internet. And in Champaign-Urbana, we encourage you to use a local line. It'll get to several lines here in the studio, 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. 9455. Belden, when you talk about a local example like this and the fact that a number of people may join a co-op just because it's the type of food they want to eat or it's the kind of prices they want to pay, lower prices, does it bring a bigger mix into that co-op, a mix of people? Are there poor people and wealthy people, and is that a good thing?
Well, my suspicion is, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about the co-op because I'm not intimately involved with the co-op.
Okay. And it's just a local, it's an example.
It's just an example,
sure,
of how an idea that started in England, and the thought there was that that would become a nationwide movement of people, not an isolated sort of thing the way it is here. So it's not an institution that I would look at and say that it fits really what the British cooperativists were thinking about. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't like it. I do, but I wouldn't use it as an example of socialism as such, but as an example of an institution here that socialists in the 19th century and early 20th century in England thought could be, if made a general pattern, could be a way in which people could enhance their financial resources and power.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest Belden Fields.
Hi, I'm really grateful to hear someone talking about socialism. On a bulletin board I post to, I jokingly refer to myself as a reformed socialist because I do believe capitalism has a place in economic society. But I wish you'd comment about some of the history of the mythology of socialism. I think a lot of people confuse it with state bloc communism and the Leninist International, without really looking at things like perhaps small cooperatives in Mexico or what was happening in Yugoslavia prior to the whole debacle that occurred there in the early 90s. You know, and especially the way now small towns are maybe having to pool together for medical care or creating cooperative grocery stores, because my personal belief is that socialism is part of the American ethic, the cooperation and, you know, getting along with your neighbors is part of our society. So I'm just curious about that. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean about when you use the word the mythology of socialism. There are certain commitments that I think are common to all socialists, and they have been part of our American experience, but they have usually been excluded from the textbooks that people read, just as the labor struggles are usually excluded in teaching about American history. I think that you did have examples of people coming together throughout American history. I'd mentioned the Utopian Socialists, for example, and there was a very wide network of communities that were of either the Owenite or the Fourierist variety, which for a while worked fairly well, effectively, were economically sound. I would be careful, however, about classifying as socialist all forms of cooperation. I happen to think, for example, that it's very healthy for cities to try to establish their own supply of power and to control that publicly, so that the citizens in the city are not subject to the whims of the market or the capriciousness of the capitalist. Certainly we with Illinois Power have experienced this, and now there's some discussion about water companies. But we have had experiments in that. I mean, you could look at TVA for a very large Tennessee Valley Authority and the supply of electricity that was extremely important in our history. So we have had certain things, certain institutions in which people worked together cooperatively, and the profit motive was not the driving force for these things. And I think that is an important part of our history.
An example, I suppose, that all cooperation is not good or in the best public interest would be the kind of collusion that sometimes happens with bid rigging and things like that on things that are apparently are supposed to be open and free. We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line four, our toll-free line. You're on Keeping the Faith with Belden Fields. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is, my understanding of socialism is that it requires a certain coherent sense of interdependence in order to work. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit how socialism scales from smaller communities where there's a really tight sense of interdependency and cooperation to larger groups and, you know, eventually to nations, whether that how socialism intends to scale that way and to maintain a sense of, you know, reciprocal kind of the reciprocal altruism that seems to be at the source of socialism. Thank you.
Well, it's an interesting question. I use the phrase how socialism intends to do something. And, of course, when we use the word intends to do, we're thinking of a certain set of institutions or set of people that intend to do something. I would phrase it a little bit differently and say how one could conceive of or how past attempts have been made to do something. Now, I think that you're right in looking at the issue of scale because it's very important. And by the way, it's important not only for socialism, it's important for democracy as such. Democracy can work a certain way at the very local level, and when you increase the scale, that poses problems, and you have to adjust for that. It involves, rather than immediate independence of people, involved in face-to-face relationships, like, let's say, a town meeting in New England. Then you get into representation, and there's more distance between people and more delegation of power. The same thing is true for socialism. I think you could conceive, however, of a society in which you had governments at a national level, which assumed a responsibility for certain things where one thought the profit motive inappropriate. For me, healthcare is the major issue. Of course, we're going in exactly the opposite direction now, with Mr. Bush's brother wishing to individualize Medicaid and turn it over to just the private sector in Florida, or pensions, as the governor of Florida wanted to turn the whole pension over to private things. So I think, however, that one could conceive of at smaller levels of people coming together and doing things cooperatively, controlling things like small power companies that would be municipally owned, and people having much greater ability to participate in that. But then at the national level, things like transportation, things like health care, certain kinds of housing policies, that would have to be done at a greater distance where you didn't have that sort of intimacy, but hopefully through democratic processes, the population would be able to democratically decide what kinds of programs they had. The crucial thing for socialists would be that you would remove the profit motive. Now, I'm not arguing that there ought to be no realm for private enterprise. I think there does need to be. What I would, however, argue, and some of you can ask me about this, is that the institution of the corporation as it exists now could not remain. That would have to be changed.
We'll get back to that in a moment, but we have another caller who's been patiently waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. Historically, the socialist analysis of how things work and could work has focused a great deal on people who are forced to who work for a wage, people who work agriculturally and are not treated fairly because the profits from their labor is somehow taken at an industrial level after their harvest. Currently, though, a lot of people are arguing that even though we're going more and more to a service economy, where you might still be the employee of a service-providing corporation, so not much has changed, even though you're not manufacturing anything, you're still a wage earner. There's also a growing trend toward individuals who are free agents, in effect. They are individual... I'm not sure what to call them. They just make a contract for a given work, for a given time, or a given project. I'm not sure how else to put that. And then they're off on their own again. What's been the recent analysis in socialist thinking of people like that who don't associate with one company officially or formally, who don't provide a service of their own, like a traditionally like a physician or lawyer, who are not tradespeople or craftspeople, but earn a living from their skill. So now we have people who, in effect, have a given skill, but still have to make contracts with large groups of one sort or another for a given place, a given time, a given project. Has that been addressed? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, when you talk about someone who is a private contractor, an independent contractor, you're still talking about someone who has certain basic needs. You're still talking about somebody who's going to require medical care. You're still talking about somebody who may very well need a pension of some sort. You're talking about somebody who is going to need all of the services, power, electricity, water, that are provided socially in our society. Now, it's true that, let's say when Marx wrote, you did have some people whom you can consider to be in the socialist tradition who wrote thinking more in agrarian terms, people like Rousseau and people like Proudhon. But it is true that the socialism really did grow up at the time of the Industrial Revolution. The European variants of socialism grew up during the time of the Industrial Revolution, where wage labor and where manufacturing were particularly important. But I think that, as you yourself indicated, even if people work in the service area, many of those people are wage earners. They are working for somebody else who controls, owns and controls the operation. So some of the premises of socialism, both in terms of their economic condition and in terms of their needs as human beings, are still there, even if they are not involved in wage labor, and their socialists would come up with certain programs that would meet the needs of those people.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Belden Fields about socialism. You are listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communication at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We have another caller waiting on line two. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was listening, and the doctor said that eventually perhaps there'd be some mix of socialism with democracy, but I immediately thought that didn't sound plausible to me, because this is kind of a odd little argument I've got here, but to me, the crux of the matter, where there's an argument between capitalism and socialism, is whether there's such a thing as economic injustice. And it seems to me that there's like many people on both sides of that argument, but that it, eventually socialism could win the argument if it considered all economic activity and its global effects, and to reflect the true fact that the Earth is essentially a spaceship in a closed system, and as such, any kind of question of justice would have more to do with a kind of planetary physiology and health than it would to do with any kind of group consensus. So I don't know if I made myself clear. It's kind of complicated, but I thought I would disagree that democracy would necessarily be a good fit with true socialism.
Let our guest ask you a clarifying question, I think.
Well, rather than do that, let me say something and see how you react to it. I think you can look at the question of the relationship between socialism and democracy in two senses. One is the obstacle to democracy that capitalism poses. And the obstacle to democracy that capitalism poses is that capitalism creates not only economic inequalities, but it creates centers of power that then are able to determine the political outcomes in societies. Now, that has been true well before the Bush administration, but I think you see it most clearly in the Bush administrations, where corporations are writing the laws that govern their sectors, and the administration just pushes them through, where basically the corporations have become so powerful, with many of them having budgets that are larger than most governmental budgets, that they are unconstrained. And there is very little that the people, in terms of their political association, can do to break through this and to insert any kind of democratic control over how their resources are being used, or what kind of distribution we have in society of wealth, or what our priorities are.
Let's see if our listener has a response to that.
Well, I think even if you got to the, even if you cleared away those obstructions or those barriers that what I would call unjust concentrations of power cause toward our progressing to democracy, even if you did that, eventually we'd get to the point where we'd realize, you know, have to face the cold fact that everything is limited on this planet, and that and there are some things that can't be, you know, wished into being. I mean, if we're talking about sustainability and all that, it would make sense to eventually base any notion of injustice on the fact that it might hinder our ability to sustain life on this planet in a way that's agreeable to all of us, and I don't see how that has much to do with democracy.
I'm going to let the caller have the last word on that for just a moment while we take a break here at the midpoint in our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon. My name is Steve Shoemaker, and we're talking about socialism with Professor Belden Fields, emeritus professor from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, who is himself a socialist, a democratic socialist, and we'll let him respond to some of those issues in just a moment. But let me take a slight break here at the halfway point and mention a couple things. Coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Jessica Culp from the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, talking about the food bank program here in Illinois. There are similar programs around the country, of course, but this is a good example. On February 6th, we'll be talking with Larry Greenfield about abortion rights. Larry Greenfield is with the Protestants for Common Good in Chicago. Later in the month of February, we'll be talking with someone who is putting together an exhibition at the Krannert Art Museum on the theme of apocalypses. So those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. It's located at 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers. And since 1937, that building has been available for students to work out of on issues of concerning the environment or do social action, community service of various types. The Y is much older than that building. It was started on this campus back in 1873, so the Y is in its 132nd year now. My name is Steve Shoemaker, and I'm the director of the Campus Y. Several programs will be starting up this next couple weeks at the beginning of this spring semester. On February 1st, a Tuesday, the first Know Your University series begins with Dean Robert Easter from the College of Agriculture and Consumer Sciences at the university. And he'll be talking about the College of ACES in a Changing World. That's a free lecture at noon at the Y, February 1st, a Tuesday. On the Friday of that week, February 4, Professor Garrett Duncan from Washington University in St. Louis will be the guest of the Y at our first Friday Forum series. We're talking about the various development goals that the United Nations has established for this new millennium. And Professor Duncan will be talking about urban schools and the fact that they seem to have been creating an entire class of individuals at risk of economic exclusion and social isolation. So we'll be talking about education as one of the Millennium Goals for the United Nations. So those two programs at the Y the first week of February on Tuesday and Friday. If you have questions, if you'd like to reserve a meal, call the Y at 337-1500. That's an area code 217. Also starting up this week and next at the Y are our various community classes, classes in dance, classes in exercise, Taibo, Pilates, language, massage, martial arts, art, music, literature, very inexpensive classes, small classes that people can find out about by calling the Y or by going online at universityymca.org. and clicking on Communiversity. Well, let's return to our topic for today. We're talking with Professor Belden Fields about socialism, and we have another caller waiting, but I'm going to postpone that just for a second. Did you want to respond to the issue
about
corporations? It was raised by the last caller.
I think that probably the most important point that he made was that resources are finite, and I think that socialists need to recognize that. Now, that wasn't always recognized. I think Karl Marx thought that, you know, the productive machine could just go and produce higher surpluses. And I think we are seeing the productive machine is doing that, the capitalist machine, and I think we see incredible wastage and use of resources in the society to produce just goods that don't add anything to the value of the society, but just keep a consumerist pattern going. For what? To make profit, to make money. Socialists think that there are other ways to assess the quality of a society rather than that consumerism, growth for growth's sake, and profit maximization. And I'll leave it at that.
We'll go to our next caller now, but if others would like to get in line, you may. The lines are open after this next call. 1-800-222-9455. We'll reach our WILL studios here from places outside Champaign-Urbana. If you can call a local line, do. That's 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Let's go to line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I tuned in a little bit late, and I heard things about transportation and housing and power and electricity and service. And anyway, I wanted to ask this question. What about the balance between resources and goods? Do you have any comment about that? I know we're a consumer society. How do we stop? I am trying very, very hard to stop buying. But how do we stop? I know socialism and democracy is a topic, but how do we stop consuming? And I'll hang up. I have not read your book. But anyway, I'll either hang up or listen.
Well, I don't think that we stop consuming. But I think that what we need to do, and no isolated individual can do, well, an isolated individual can make a decision to live a more simple life, but that doesn't resolve the problem of resource allocation at a level of the nation or the world, the global nation. So I think what has to be done is that we have to establish some kind of criteria. I mean, a lot of what is produced right now, everything that we do produce is going to use some resource. It's going to use a mineral. It's going to use iron, steel, plastics that are made from petroleum, cars that pollute. There are all kinds of social costs with production and consumption. And if you just run along the logic of capitalism, it's just too bad. In fact, the pollution itself is seen as a commodity. You trade your pollution rights, quote unquote, now, which to me appears perverse. But I think that what one would have to do, and I think what most socialists would argue, is there has to be a democratic discussion as to how we are going to use scarce resources, and that should not just be left to people who want to make money off of those resources. So I'm not suggesting that we become hair shirts, that we not consume anything, but that we consume reasonably. And in that sense, I think that there needs to be a merger between socialists and environmentalists. It was felt for a while that there had to be an antagonism, particularly with Marxists who would take the position, one, that there was unlimited potential to produce surpluses in this society, and secondly, that they were concerned that any of the restrictions would hurt workers because of the economic consequences to workers. I think those are false dichotomies, because if we just deplete our resources, workers are going to be hurt the way anybody else is going to be hurt. And also we have to have an intergenerational perspective on this. We can use up all the resources now, but then what happens to future generations when those resources are depleted? The point is, this shouldn't just be left to the market. The point is that this should be a matter of democratic discussion and debate. But you don't see it in the political process in the United States today. You don't see that kind of debate because the political system has been captured largely by the corporate interests. That's why you don't see the debate.
We're not discussing any particular book of yours, Belden, but you have published. Tell our listeners what some of your recent books are.
Well, probably the book that would be the one that addresses some of these issues best would be a book that I published in 2003 called Rethinking Human Rights for the New Millennium. And I look at the issue of human rights. One of the arguments, points of debate in human rights literature and polemical discussions is how do we look at the relationship between what are known, sometimes called the first generation of human rights, the political and civil human rights, the right to speak, to vote, etc., and social and economic rights, the right to health care, the right to decent housing, the right to employment at a salary that you can live and raise a family on. And I probe that relationship. And I also probe the problem that is posed to human rights by the present structure of the corporation, which I think disempowers people.
We have another caller waiting on line one. You're on the air with Belden Fields. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. First, a comment. One very important aspect of our local food co-op, and I think all co-ops, is that the policies in the store are set by the members. So we decide what we're going to buy. We buy locally. We're not going to have packaging. We buy in bulk. And we make all those decisions ourselves. So we're totally in control of how it's run. And I think that's a really important aspect of a co-op. And another example, I think, of a co-op would be a credit union, except that it's about money. So we, like the University of Illinois, we loan money to ourselves at a lower rate, and we earn, hopefully, savings at a slightly higher rate because there's not somebody making a profit. It's all about us, and we also get to make some decisions. And then I have a question. I think somebody kind of touched on it, but it seems to me that people have a negative notion about what socialism is, and sometimes when I look at the way things happen in our government, although it's politics, it seems as though we have some of it, but it seems to benefit rich fat cats and big corporations and not little people. So we bail out airlines, but we don't bail out. We don't always bail out mass transit and Amtrak the way we could. It kind of gets all screwed up. Could you comment on why people have such negative notions about what socialism is? Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Well, I think this is ingrained in people. It's socialism. Particularly after the Soviet Revolution in 1917, socialism was associated with the Soviet Union, and that system grew into a totalitarian system, so people associated it with that. But also even in terms of the struggles in the United States that involved in socialism, there's a rich history of socialism. In the United States, socialism was simply that history was expunged from the school books, so nobody could sensibly talk about socialism because they didn't have any basis. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know the history. They didn't know the ideas of socialism. Let me give you a
although Social Security is certainly.
Yeah, I mean, socialists were driven to say if anybody wanted to pass Social Security, they said, no, it isn't socialist.
Right,
you know.
Right.
Let me give you an interesting little story. I take my class when I teach a course in socialist theory down to New Harmony, Indiana, and they have an orientation with a film. And they talk about the initial Rappite experience down there, the Christian communist experience. And then when they get to Robert Owen, they only refer to him as an educator. Well, of course, he was an educator, but also, very importantly, for somebody that's interested in socialist history, he was one of the most important utopian socialists. So I said to my class, you know, listen to how they refer to Owen in this. And then I raised the question, and I said to the woman who was giving this orientation, why don't you tell people that Owen was a socialist? And she said, it just has, you know, such a negative meaning. But that's the kind of suppression. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of ideological victory that has been had by capitalism over socialism. Just wipe out the history. And, of course, people don't know anything about it.
We have another caller again on line one, one of our local lines. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Professor Belden Fields.
Belden, I've listened to I was called away for a few minutes. I didn't get to hear everything, and I hope I'm not repetitive. But you've talked very interestingly about the Americans' continuing concern with socialism over a long period of time. But the fact is that socialism has never amounted to very much in this country. There are certainly ups and downs. In 1912, it was quite popular, the early 20th century. What I'd like to have you do is talk about why you think that socialism has never been a very significant development in this nation. That's good for now. Thank you.
I think there's several responses to that. I think that part of the reason that it hasn't was, well, as I already said, that the association with the Soviet Union was quite deadly. And you're right that earlier on, for example, if you look at the end of the 19th century, Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, which was a book about a socialist project for the United States, outsold every book but the Bible in the United States. If you looked at Debs's getting a million votes for president during the First World War, while he was sitting in a prison cell, you can see the kind of support that socialism did have. But it faded. I think part of it he has to do, as I say, with the association with the Soviet Union and the totalitarianism there. I think part of it he had to do with the kind of individualism that developed in the United States. I mean, we go to Turner's Thesis of the Frontier, whatever, but the rugged individuals who just, you know, take care of themselves, and that myth or history of the United States. I think there was an attempt to define socialism as something foreign to the United States, part of American exceptionalism that was just an import, which isn't true. Part of it was an import from Europe, but it wasn't completely. And then I think the fact that socialism was defeated. It was defeated, it was crushed through force of arms. That is to say, the Socialist Party was attacked because of its stance in World War I against the U.S. entry into the war. It was made to look unpatriotic for that. And it was repressed. You as well as I, better than I, know the history of McCarthyism in the United States, and socialism was conflated with totalitarian communism. So it simply, ideologically, through force of arms and through being attacked as a foreign import, it was driven out. And now it's even, I mean, the control over the media now, this is an exception, right? The control over the media makes it very difficult. When you look at your television programs, even on PBS, how many socialists do you have commenting and giving their view on the American political system? You have people who are sort of liberal and then sort of middle of the roaders and then conservative people, but you don't have socialists.
We're talking with Belden Fields about socialism. Let me ask a question that hasn't been directly asked, but some people make the argument in relation to corporations. You said that corporations were really an obstacle to democracy.
Yes.
Some people make the argument that corporations are very cooperative, and particularly with including spreading out ownership among the stockholders, that this is a very democratic institution. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not a democratic institution because the decisions are made by people at the very top. Of those. Most of the stockholders, I mean, there are attempts to organize among stockholders for specific issues, environmentalists and so on, who will buy stocks in a corporation and try to influence it. But that's not where the power is, and everybody knows that's not where the power is. The power is with the CEO and the high officers and also the people on the board, but very often the people on the board just rubber stamp what the corporate leadership wants. I would like to get something in before we close, because
sure.
I think it's important. If you would like to discuss these issues further, I do belong to something called Socialist Forum, and we meet every third Thursday. I'm sorry, please, every third Saturday from 3 to 5 at the Independent Media Center, 218 West Main Street in Urbana. You don't have to be a socialist to come to that. If you're just interested in discussing these ideas and learning some of the things that we do, we put on a lot of fora on elections, we raise the issues, we get decent coverage usually from the News Gazette. But I would urge people, if you are interested in this, to further the discussions, please come every third Saturday from 3 to 5 at the IMC.
Independent Media Center, and give the address again.
218 West Main Street in Urbana. It's across from Busey Bank. That wasn't done to irritate Busey Bank.
In talking about socialism, one critique that's often raised is that if everything is held in common, what's the motivation for people to get out and do, to work hard, to not just be lazy and take the goods that are shared and let other people really produce them? How do you respond to that kind of a notion that individual human evil can keep socialism from actually working?
Well, first of all, I don't think everything should be held in common. I think there are certain things that should be publicly held, in some cases the state, in some cases independent bodies from the state, but bodies of a public nature, in some cases cooperatively owned. But I'm not arguing that each and everything should be owned cooperatively or publicly. So that's number one. The second thing is that I think that human nature is very complex. I think that there is no blank human nature, no abstract human nature, that we are molded by the institutions and relationships in which we find ourselves. And if you have a capitalist system as strong as this system is, controlling the ideology the way it does, it's going to reproduce people who are acquisitive, who are greedy. And as I say, those are things that capitalists themselves seem to admire.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking today with Professor Emeritus Belden Fields from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign about socialism. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Jessica Culp, talking about the programs and services of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. On February 6, our guest will be Larry Greenfield from Protestants for the Common Good, talking about abortion rights. I might take a moment to make an announcement about the death of a friend of the program and a couple times a guest on the program, the Reverend Bruce Heck, Lutheran pastor in Champaign-Urbana and in Rankin, Illinois. Died last week. His memorial service will be this coming Wednesday at 11 o'clock in Rankin at the Grace Lutheran Church. We extend sympathies to friends and family of Reverend Bruce Heck. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. If you have questions for me or suggestions for future programs, please feel free to call me at the University YMCA at 337-1500. That's an area code 217. Thank you again to our callers and to our guest, Belden Fields. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
There's something about the desert. Its uncompromising nature makes it a place of thirst and death, but it's also the site of myths and vision quests. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll discover the passion and power of the desert. We'll talk to the desert's poets and commemorate some of its victims. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 Central Time, here on WILL Urbana.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low around 16 degrees and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 30s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s and southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.